Welcome, welcome, welcome. Another edition of Smart Talk. I'm your host, Al Bergeson, and my guest today is Professor David Gibbs from the University of Arizona, whom I've known for a long time. We used to do some public access television together, and it just dawned on me that if I were to think of public intellectuals at the University of Arizona, David would be at the top or near the top of that list. Now, recently we've added Noam Chomsky, and of course he is a very famous public intellectual, but he's relatively new to the U of A. David's been here for a long time and has engaged the public with op-ed pieces, with public debates, and a variety of other things in which he deals with difficult topics in an interesting and provocative way. So on our agenda today, we got four topics we're going to get David's opinion on, and I want you folks to call in if you have your opinion too. Again, 790-2040, and that's our call-in number. Today we're going to talk about humanitarian interventions. The good, are they bad? Are they just an excuse for a big country to get its way? Or are there some things for which if we don't do something or someone doesn't do something, a lot of people get hurt or a lot of people die, and they are, in fact, justified. We're also going to talk about money in politics. This one, of course, is an eternal issue. Does it provide a way for people and groups to express themselves, or is it just a way for the powerful and the rich to continue to control politics? Our third topic we're going to get to is the Democratic Party and why does it seem to be somewhat disconnected from its sort of past and heritage? What I'm thinking here is, how did the party of Franklin Roosevelt and the great and the New Deal become one that could lose to Donald Trump and the Republicans? And finally, although we may move this up earlier if we decide to, finally, there is the question of political correctness. This is very controversial in the country today. David has some real opinions on it, and I bet you folks do too. So give us a call anytime during the show that you want, 790-2040. David, let's start out with the humanitarian intervention issue. And I know you recently went to Oxford, England, and Oxford University to participate in these famed Oxford debates. So just give me a little sense. You've been in Tucson for years, the desert, the Southwest, the warmth. What were your impressions of Oxford, the university?
Well, it's beautiful. It's physically beautiful. The building we were in was lovely. I debated Michael Chertoff, who was the Secretary of Homeland Security under George W. Bush, and we debated for about an hour on the topic of humanitarian intervention. He basically gave a qualified yes, he favored it. No, I was opposed to it. I think it's a very bad idea.
So right off the top, the title is Humanitarian Intervention. Help your fellow man. People are starving. There's been a typhoon in the Philippines. Shouldn't the Seventh Fleet lend an aircraft carrier with hospital facilities as an intervention to try and help people? What could possibly be wrong with humanitarian, if it was humanitarian, intervention?
Well, I think humanitarian military intervention is what I'm against. And I think mostly it's a misuse of words. These things are not very humanitarian. We just call them that. Look at the interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya. All three were claimed to be, in part, humanitarian in nature. The first two, Iraq and Afghanistan, partly. Libya was almost entirely considered humanitarian intervention, and the results were catastrophic from the standpoint of humanitarian effect. Huge numbers of people died. In Iraq alone, 10 years ago, there was a study in a British journal that claimed 650,000 people died from the war. That's much more than died under Saddam Hussein, and that was caused by the U.S. intervention. And so I think most of the time, what people don't realize is these interventions often do more harm than good. I think that's my bottom line here. The effect of these things is terrible from a humanitarian standpoint, and there are much simpler things we could do that are much more humanitarian. Public health, vaccination of children, these things are inexpensive and risk-free, and I think we should do that and forget about the military side.
So if I'm remembering correctly, and help me if I'm not, Afghanistan in some sense was about bin Laden or about 9/11. Mm-hmm. So if I were to take the other side and say, we've been attacked in 9/11. The attacker resides somewhere there, and as a safe haven. Right. And so humanitarianism, hell, this is just a straight military operation. If you also make the argument that in the past, Gaddafi shooting down the airline had been involved in some terrorism, there's no humanitarianism involved here with the other than a fig leaf. This is straight out someone who's done things. And same thing with Iraq. There was an argument about reordering the Middle East if it was becoming a place of Islamic terrorism. So maybe the justification of it, well, isn't it just as legitimate to say that these weren't humanitarian things in the first place?
Well, in a sense, I agree with that, that humanitarianism was a cover, but there really was a cover. In Afghanistan, yes, it was mostly even publicly about bin Laden, the 9/11 attacks, but also a secondary factor was the oppressiveness of the Taliban, their mistreatment of women. That was part of the selling point in favor of the war in Iraq. You know, Saddam Hussein tortures his own people and so on. And it wasn't just the Bush administration, but academics like myself were very big advocates of these things, and the results were disastrous. And nobody says they're sorry for having advocated these things. Libya was sold almost entirely as a humanitarian intervention. Again, I don't think it really was that even an intent. But in terms of the public record, in terms of the way it was sold to the public, it was sold as an exclusively humanitarian intervention. And again, the results were disastrous. It didn't just destabilize Libya, it destabilized much of North Africa. It made things worse from a humanitarian standpoint. And I find it disturbing that the people who've advocated for these things have never even expressed regret or said they're sorry for it when they've produced a disaster. And I think future humanitarian interventions that have been proposed in places like Syria or North Korea or Myanmar, the odds are high. Those two would produce humanitarian disasters. And we have to learn from our mistakes and not repeat our mistakes. And I'm afraid of that not happening.
Are there any good, successful humanitarian interventions you could think of?
In a sense, yes. Randomly, there have been interventions that have turned out to have a humanitarian effect. I'll give you one good example. In 1979, Cambodia was ruled by the Khmer Rouge, who were a brutal dictatorship killing vast numbers of people, and Vietnam invaded Cambodia. They did it with no humanitarian intent. They did it for reasons that were purely self-interested, but I think everybody agrees that the humanitarian situation in Cambodia improved after the Vietnamese intervention. If you throw enough darts, eventually you'll hit the bullseye. You will randomly find interventions that unintentionally do some good. But I think that's a big part of that is luck. I think generally speaking, intervention has terrible results, often terrible if unpredictable results. And the best thing about intervention is just not to do it. If you want to spend money on something, there are much cheaper ways to save lives that are much more effective and less risky.
Is it fair to call you an America First non-interventionist?
You know, I don't like the term America First. It sounds like isolationism. I'm not an isolationist. I think engagement is a good thing. I just think that non-military forms of engagement are the way to go. And the military forms of engagement mostly have had a very negative effect. I do think what you're saying, though, is that there's been a scrambling of ideologies. Anti-intervention used to be a liberal idea. It's not liberal at all anymore. A lot of people voted for Donald Trump, I think mistakenly, but nevertheless voted for Donald Trump because they believed he was less likely to be interventionist than Hillary Clinton. So this has really not become a liberal conservative issue anymore. But I think that the public is very much turned against interventionism, and in my view, rightly so.
I listened to some of the tape. Your wife sent me the tape of you and Chertoff in Oxford. It was fascinating. His position, as I understood it from the parts that I listened to, was something to the effect of, well, son, it wasn't quite well, son, but it was like condescending feel to, well, son, you know, I hear this and I hear that, but you know, it's like war. War is hell. Interventionism, even if we mean well, is hell. And the other part is, I've got to make a decision. The administration has to make a decision. If we had the time or the information that you would like to have before you did something, God knows how many more, in theory, would die or it would get worse. And so I hear what you're saying. I wish I could. Again, almost patting you on the head. But, you know, those of us in real power, those of us having to make decisions instantaneously, just can't afford the time to think about things that you academics think is necessary. How did you respond to him?
You know, being in power entails responsibility, and there's the issue of responsibility for your actions. And if you make a catastrophic decision, you're responsible for that decision. And saying it was a difficult decision is no good answer. And so I just don't think that's a good answer to say that these are difficult decisions. The fact is that there was good evidence they had before them, that Chertoff and his friends in the Bush administration had before them, that indicated that an Iraq invasion would be a disaster, but they did it anyway. And they're responsible for having made that decision. I don't feel a lot of sympathy for that argument.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'm going to ask David where he fears the next humanitarian intervention by the United States will be coming. Stick with us. Smart Talk, Al Bergeson, your host, and our guest today is Professor David Gibbs, University of Arizona History, one of our great public intellectuals out here in the Southwest, and it's a real honor to have him with us. I want to ask you, David, you've talked about interventions, some good, mostly bad, dangerous, etc. Where do you fear the next American intervention for humanitarian reasons might occur?
The one I fear most is North Korea. I think there are definitely elements in the foreign policy establishment who want to do regime change in North Korea. And, you know, it'll be justified in a lot of grounds. One of those grounds will certainly be humanitarianism, to liberate the people of North Korea from a very bad dictator. And Kim Jong-un is a very bad dictator. And if the United States does do regime change in North Korea, I think it's likely, it'll produce the biggest humanitarian catastrophe since 1945. It'll have, it could very well make Iraq look like a picnic in comparison. And so I think that all the problems we've seen in humanitarian interventionism could very well blow up in our faces if we do regime change in North Korea. But I think that is at least a possibility, a realistic possibility.
Do you think, in saying that, that we haven't learned from the Korean War, where, yes, South Korea invaded by North Korea, but as the Americans pushed up, there was pressure to keep going north, and that activated the Chinese. In short, would the Chinese react or allow to have American presence literally on their border with a pro-American regime and possibly American missiles a few hundred miles from Beijing? And South Korea, would they also want this to happen?
Yeah, I think that the issue of China is definitely an issue. I think the biggest issue is going to be how North Korea responds. North Korea is known to have a small number of primitive nuclear weapons and some kind of delivery systems. Plus, they have thousands of pieces of artillery, some embedded in mountains, that can reach Seoul, which is one of the world's biggest metropolitan areas. And they could do an enormous amount of damage in just a few days. Plus, there's the problem of disorder. If North Korea, if order disintegrates in North Korea, you could have a really mass famine in North Korea and mass loss of life due to disorder. I think in South Korea, at every level, they're very frightened of the prospect of regime change on the whole, precisely for those reasons. This would be a matter that would be right on their doorstep, and it would have major implications for them. Japan would be very concerned because they could possibly be reached by some of North Korea's missiles. And any disorder would be right next to them across the sea. And, of course, there's the issue of China as well. But I think that the most immediate one is mass loss of life due to the immediate conflict associated with regime change, which could be colossal.
790-2040, that's the call-in number. If you have an opinion on some of these topics and want to ask David a question, disagree with him, agree with him, please give us a call. Let's switch to money and politics.
Right.
It's an eternal. It's always been there. It gets pushed back sometimes. It comes back sometimes. In your opinion, having studied this, and presently right now, as I remember, you are working a book on this.
Yes.
What is the biggest downside or danger to money in politics?
Well, it fundamentally violates the principle of democracy, which is one person, one vote, that the will of the people should be affected in government policy. And it violates that in that we have a very considerable concentration of wealth in this country, and people with concentrated wealth, let's say the Koch brothers with $82 billion at their disposal, almost as large as the GDP of Puerto Rico, they vote twice. They vote once in the ballot box, and then they vote with their money. and their money buys a lot more influence than their actual ballot box votes do. And that's very unfair that two people with $82 billion should be able to wield that kind of power based upon factors that have nothing to do with democracy, that are mentioned nowhere in the Constitution. And so I think that fundamental violation of democracy is something I find very disturbing.
Are most elections decided by which candidate had the most money?
There was a recent study by...
Political science-wise.
There was a recent study by a political scientist at the Institute for New Economic Thinking, a Soros Foundation, that concluded that one of the best predictors of elections is indeed who has better funding. And funding is a very good predictor of elections, which is exactly what common sense would tell you. You know, you don't get rich people giving money to candidates for fun. They give it to them because they want influence, and they usually get that influence.
I was going to say the other side would be little people, issue people, concerned people who band together to raise money. In the past, I suppose, organized labor the, quote, working man. Would this hurt them? Not being able to now, but that's the only way they could have any influence would be to pool their money.
Right.
But once money's out, then they don't have that.
Oh, I see. Well, you know, you do have the thing that basically masses of people who are not wealthy can use numbers against the wealthy. You know, the wealthy have money, the masses of people have numbers, and numbers can prevail. Also, people can pool together their money. In fact, in 2016, the evidence is very strong. Bernie Sanders was the first major presidential candidate in possibly a century that got almost all of his money from small donations, none of any significance, from wealthy or business interests, and that can be done. But the very idea, basically, of buying elections is something that inevitably is going to favor the wealthy against the non-wealthy. And that's very fundamentally unfair. And the issue goes much deeper than that, and you don't only buy politicians, but you can, for example, buy academics.
It's interesting that they don't have the money influence in dictatorships, but it's only when you open it up to everyone that you get a competition between people. We got to take a break.
Sure.
Stick with us. We're going to turn to our next topic, which is the Democratic Party. Why aren't they winning these national elections, and what's their plan to deal with Trump? Stick with us. Smart Talk, Al Bergeson, your host, here with David Gibbs, professor of history at the University of Arizona. And we have a caller. Ingrid, you're on the air. You got a question for my guest. Ingrid.
Hello. Oh, good morning. You talked about the Democratic Party. And earlier, a couple of other things. You know, we don't live, our government is not a democracy. The Constitution, the form of government was arrived at somewhat democratically, based on almost libertarian principles, not exactly. Women were left out of a lot of things, not to mention slavery. So how do you, why do Democrats keep saying we're in a democracy? We've got the Electoral College. That is not a democratic principle. I think the founders wanted to have a lot of control over how elections are would result. And then you have to consider little states like Rhode Island. They get to send two senators to Congress, regardless of the size of the population. When is this going to be acknowledged? I'll leave it at that.
Ingrid, that's a great question. And David?
Well, it's true. I think there's no doubt that the founders didn't really intend the democracy in any proper sense for all the reasons you've noted. And there's still a lot of overtly non-democratic features in the system. The Electoral College and the Senate, which you mentioned, are two of the most striking ones. One might say the legality of gerrymandering is another undemocratic feature. Voter suppression, which apparently so far at least is considered constitutional, is yet another. And so there are many non-democratic features in it. I think the key is that at this point in history, everybody of both parties at least publicly says the system in principle should be democratic. And so that's not really open to dispute. The question is how to achieve that. And, you know, overcoming these undemocratic features is a real issue. And I think one we'll have to deal with. I think an even larger one that I would emphasize is the role of money, which I think is the most undemocratic feature of all.
The electoral... Oh, sorry. Ingrid, thanks for the call. It's good to hear your voice again for calling in regularly, as you do. The Electoral College seems to go against one man, one vote. Do you think someday we will get rid of it, change it, something?
The problem with this is you need a constitutional amendment, and that's very difficult to do. It requires years. It requires organizing. And to me, at least, that's not the most... If you're going to put time into organizing over an issue, I wouldn't say that's at the top of my list. I would say maybe a constitutional amendment against privately funded elections would be higher on my list, as I would see that as a more important corruption of democracy than the Electoral College. But certainly reforming the Electoral College would be a good thing. I would support it if it were on the agenda.
Yeah. Let's switch to something coming up sort of in the future. I'll put it to you this way. Will the Democrats beat Trump in 2020? Your opinion.
Well, you know, my degree actually is in political science, not in history. And in political science, they have these models that predict elections. And the strongest predictor of elections with regard to presidents being reelected is the economy. If the economy is growing, the president is usually reelected. The economy is currently growing, and that tends to work in Trump's favor very heavily. That also incumbencies the incumbent. And based upon those two factors, I would say the odds would somewhat favor Trump. Now, he's not a very popular president, that's clear. But he may have just enough popularity to win. I think that the Democrats are overestimating his weakness, in my view, and they're not fully paying attention to the fact that the economy is in growth mode right now. Whether it's Trump's fault or not doesn't really matter. He will get credit for that, and that may very well put him over the top and reelect him, unfortunately, because I'm not a big fan of Trump, but that's the reality.
If you were to do a... analysis of Trump and his election and things that the Democratic Party seemed to have, or its candidates seemed to have missed, a little laundry list of, wow, we never thought of that, or wow, you know, the upper Midwest, we didn't even camp Hillary, we didn't even campaign there. What are the main things, in your opinion, that the Democrats have missed that has contributed to the electoral victory by Trump?
I think the key one is becoming detached from the working class. I think that, you know, the Democratic Party in its modern form was forged during the New Deal, and celebration of the working class and working people was very much part of it. And the culture celebrated working people. And I think the Democrats have become detached from that. Liberalism has become detached from the working class. And I think that's one of the most important pathologies of the Democrats. And I think that was a major factor in electing Trump. That a sort of condescending attitude towards the working class resulted in the working class returning the favor, and many of them voted for Trump. And I think that could very well re-elect Trump if that trend continues.
Raising the question, why did the party of the working class abandon, in your opinion, the working class?
It's a tough one. That's a book I'm writing now which focuses on that. I think it was in the 60s and the 70s. And in the 60s and the 70s, the political left was the anti-war movement. And that was mostly kind of a middle-class movement of college students. And, you know, the labor unions were very anti-communist. And so you had this split between the labor unions and the anti-war movement. And I think much of it comes out of that. I looked at many of the movies from the 70s, and a lot of them were very hostile to the working class. They presented working-class whites, especially white males, as bigoted, violent, ignorant, and really in very kind of mean-spirited ways, in my view. I mean, obviously, we should oppose bigotry and things like that, but the kind of broad brush sort of smearing of a whole social group like that really was unnecessary. And I think it led to a lot of contributed to a lot of poisonous politics. The right, of course, contributed even more, but I think liberals had their own role in creating these kinds of wedges, social wedges between groups that are very divisive, and they continue to be divisive and help demagogues like Trump.
It's been said that the Democratic Party switched, shifted, or added on, but let go of something when it added on, new constituencies to emphasize electorally. The idea being that demography was on our side. And I'm referring here now to the Democratic Party vis-a-vis women, vis-a-vis Hispanics, vis-a-vis African Americans, vis-a-vis all kinds of minorities, and with a shrinking white population demographically, it was just a matter of time if you were for those groups and not for the white working class, electoral victory would come your way. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, part of this is justified in the sense that we do have a problem of racism in this country, and the Democrats have been emphasizing that issue. We do have a problem, clearly, of mistreatment of women in this country, and that also has been emphasized, and rightly so. Gay rights is an important issue. I feel strongly about that. But I think, you know, what's left out of this is the working class and economic rights, and I think that's really what's been left out here. The Democrats mostly have been focusing on issues of racism, sexism, gender rights, and so on, and they've simply forgotten about the economic rights of people who've lost their jobs and lost their livelihoods. And, you know, then they're surprised when they go and vote for Donald Trump. Now, the demographic idea is that non-whites are increasing and whites are decreasing, and that is true. You just look at the demographics. But the white population is still so large. It's going to be very influential for many decades, and it's very foolish of the Democrats to simply write off working-class whites as unimportant. Because we just saw in the last election, they're not unimportant, and they'd elected Donald Trump, and they could reelect him. And that the Democrats, I think, are underestimating that danger.
We talk about the reelection in 2020, because it's coming up, and it makes sense. Let's go back to 2016. Why do you think people did vote for Trump? I know there's no answer, but what did they hear from him or want to hear from him that led them to vote for someone who had never held office and had a list of negatives attached to him, perhaps never seen in presidential elections?
Well, I think that there's, you know, good and bad reasons. I mean, the bad reasons are there is no doubt there is a certain sense of lingering racism in the United States and a reaction against a black president and a kind of a response by electing a very bigoted white president, Donald Trump. But there also were other reasons that I think I view more sympathetically, which is a lot of people who voted for Trump were in deindustrialized areas of the Middle West, in farming areas where people have lost their farms. And the Democrats have simply abandoned these people for the most part. And Hillary Clinton was very open about really not being very concerned about people who have had their lives devastated by laissez-faire capitalism. And, you know, Trump at least verbally seemed to be concerned about them. Now, his policies have been disastrous for people who are hurting in these areas, but he verbally talked about being concerned about them. And I think that contributed to his popularity. And I think this is still a problem that you have the Democrats mostly focusing upon identity issues rather than economic and class issues. The only major exception is Bernie Sanders and to some extent, to a more limited degree, I would say Elizabeth Warren. But on the whole, the idea of the Democrats is focusing on identity politics exclusively or overwhelmingly. And I think that's a very big mistake. And I think that the Democrats need more self-reflection, more self-awareness, more sense of acknowledging they did things wrong in the past and they need to learn from their mistakes. And I'm disappointed to see they're not doing that.
If you were to handicap a handful of Democratic candidates in terms of strengths and weaknesses and chances against Trump, I'll throw out some names and give me a quick thumbnail sketch of their chances. Start with Bernie Sanders.
Well, I do think Bernie Sanders, in my view, is the one who's best positioned to oppose Trump, and that basically he is the only candidate that I've seen who was able to appeal to a broad range of people, including, yes, Trump voters, working class whites. He does seem to have had significant support in places like rural areas of West Virginia and Kentucky. And I'm really surprised about that, and that this left-wing socialist guy who comes from New York with a Brooklyn accent is able to appeal to these people, but he does. And I haven't really seen that with any of the other Democratic candidates so far. I think that what's weighing against Bernie Sanders is, first of all, he's a white male in a year when I think the Democrats don't want to elect a white male. And secondly, I think his kind of economic populism sells better in a period of economic austerity than it does in a period of growth. And unfortunately for him, we are in a period of growth right now, and his capacity to pitch his views is limited by the fact that we are temporarily in an economic upswing. And so that, I think, will work against him. But I still think that Bernie Sanders would be the best candidate if beating Trump is your priority.
Joe Biden.
Joe Biden has the advantage of being the establishment candidate. The Democratic establishment remains behind him as the one with the best connections to the establishment. The problem with him is that basically he's just running on nostalgia for the Obama period. And I just wonder how effective that's going to be, you know, in the general election. You know, he claims to have a kind of working class style, but, you know, he's been in the Senate and in the vice presidency almost his entire life. So he just doesn't seem like a very effective person to appeal to the working man or working woman. He's the ultimate insider, and I just don't think insider candidates would be very effective right now. He's also, as we've seen, a gaffe machine. He really has very little self-control, not as bad as Trump, perhaps, but he seems to make a huge number of mistakes when he's running. We've seen that again and again, and so I think he's less effective than people think.
Talking with David Gibbs, professor of history at the University of Arizona, 790-2040 is the caller number, and where David's handicapping Democratic candidates against President Trump in 2020. Kamala Harris.
Well, you know, I if I had a bet on anybody becoming the nominee, she's increasingly looking like the most probable in that she's very comfortable with the establishment and the establishment is comfortable with her. She gets a lot of money from the powerful interests that backed Hillary. She's young. She's verbally sharp and effective. She's not white in a year when, you know, having a non-white candidate is something the Democrats seem to be moving towards. And she's female. And all those things, I think, would weigh in favor of her being the most likely person to get the nomination. The problem is she's not really, she doesn't seem very credible on the economic populism angle. And I don't think her capacity to win over Trump voters is going to be very strong. I think she'll appeal to the Democratic establishment, to traditional constituencies who vote for the Democrats. But her ability to feel, the key voters here are the voters who voted for Obama and then voted for Trump, who flipped to Trump. And the Democrats need to win them back. And I just don't see her as a very strong candidate for winning them back.
Pete Buttigieg. Mayor Pete from South Bend.
I just can't take seriously somebody whose only political experience is mayor of South Bend, Indiana. You know, he's running mostly on the fact that he was a Rhodes Scholar, he's bright, he speaks Norwegian. You know,
Experience.
That's true, he had military experience, that's right. But on the whole, you know, he doesn't really seem to have that much substance behind him as far as I can tell. And I don't really see somebody with the very limited experience he's had in politics as a serious contender.
Elizabeth Warren.
Well, she's another candidate who would seem to have a real shot at the nomination. She's rising in the polls. She's articulate. She's effective. A lot of the issues are the economic populist issues that I think the Democrats need to move on. She is female in a year when, you know, a female has advantages in terms of winning the nomination. Somehow, I just don't think that she'd be an effective candidate for the party, though. She still seems like more of a Harvard professor. The Harvard affiliation itself will not play well in the general election. There is the issue that, yes, she did not accurately report her American Indian ancestry when she applied for a job at Harvard. Personally, I think that's not a big deal, but it will be made a big deal. And the claim she's Pocahontas, we'll hear that again and again and again and again. And I think it'll distract from all the other issues that need to be aired. And so I don't see her as a very effective standard bearer for the Democratic Party in terms of beating Trump.
There seems to be a goodly number of Democratic candidates who endorse a Democratic socialist or at least a more left, more progressive, left-wing policies and stuff. What's your feeling that swinging so far left, if they get elected, will harm them in the general when they're going to have to swing back to the center?
Well, it depends on which issues. You know, it's very hard to generalize. Some issues have become very scrambled. I mean, anti-interventionism used to be a left-wing issue. It's not anymore. There are a lot of people in middle America, veterans, who are anti-interventionist. Economic populism, going after the big banks, for example, that's no longer just a liberal issue. There are a lot of people who voted for Trump, I think, who are very ready for an assault against the wealthy, against the banks. So I think economic populism and anti-interventionism could play very well among traditional, you know, Republican voters or at least independents. Now, on the cultural and identity politics issues, that's another matter. And I think that's a much more partisan issue. Partisan Democrats like those issues. Republicans and independents do not like those issues. And that's where you get a much clearer partisan divide. I think one of the mistakes the Democrats have been making is that after the election of Trump, rather than swinging towards the economic populism, they'd swung hard towards the identity politics issues. Often ignoring or at least downplaying economic populism. And I think that's a mistake. And it's a mistake in terms of beating Donald Trump. If beating Donald Trump is what you want to do, I don't think doubling down on identity politics is the way to go. Now, that does not mean abandoning the issue of anti-racism or anti-sexism, but it does mean at least mixing that with issues that will appeal to those who've lost their farms or lost their jobs or lost their livelihoods. And, I think that just focusing upon a certain set of identity issues, I think, and doing that alone, or at least overwhelmingly, is a recipe for losing the election.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to tackle this topic of political correctness, the good, the bad, the indifferent, whatever. Stick with us. Give us a call if you have an opinion on political correctness, 790-2040. Smart Talk, your host, Al Bergeson, here with David Gibbs, professor of history at the University of Arizona, and one of the great public intellectuals here in Southern Arizona. And it's always a joy to talk to David about issues. He's always provocative. Let's turn to political correctness. You passed me earlier in the week an article from the Atlantic Monthly in which a large survey of many Americans was done, and they were asked, what do they think of political correctness? What were the findings in a nutshell?
Well, the term political correctness, however you define it, just is not popular. And I think it was striking to me how unpopular it was. This was in The Atlantic, by the way, and the person who wrote it was a faculty member at Harvard. And what the survey showed was that 80% of Americans, when asked about political correctness, said they don't like it, meaning that it's overwhelmingly unpopular. And it's unpopular among almost every single demographic group. And what surprised me, and this did surprise me, is that contrary to popular belief, it is no more popular among non-whites than among whites, among blacks, American Indians, among Hispanics, Asians, everybody. It's unpopular. And age is not a good predictor. It's not just old people who don't like it. Young people don't like it either. So it's pretty much across the board unpopular. But it seems to be very popular among academics and among journalists and among people who participate in public discussion. And so you get a real divide between the mass of the public on the one hand and the public, people who are engaged in elite discussion on the other hand. And I think that's very dangerous.
I should have. I will now. What do we mean by political correctness, for those who may not know? And what are some examples?
That's a very good question. And one of the problems with this is it's a very vague term, obviously. And I think for most people, what the term connotes is two things. First of all, a tone of elitism and a lot of very long polysyllabic words. Like intersectionality, for example, is a favorite right now. It's a real turnoff to most people. I think most academics, when they use terms like this, don't realize what a turnoff it is. And the second thing is, I think, a tone of bullying. And one does see that on college campuses. When people say the wrong thing or make a speech people don't like, there's a tendency to bully. I think, you know, right-wingers focus on this and tend to exaggerate it. They overstate it. If you read right-wing newspapers, it's full of these events at college campuses. They overdo it. But these things do happen. I have seen them with my own eyes. And, it casts the left in a very problematic light. Bullying is not popular with the public, and elitism isn't popular either. And, I wish the people, fellow people on the left, would realize that, the left needs to speak in a language accessible to common people, to ordinary people, that doesn't insult them. And I think a lot of political correctness involves in language that condescends and insults ordinary people.
When I think of political correctness, or what I guess I wanted us to get to, I'll just give my version now, is a movement in which it's correct, proper, right thing to do morally to use certain language when addressing people, and that certain groups' choice of how they want to be addressed is something for their self-respect and honoring them as what they are should be acknowledged. If one doesn't do that, one is engaging in what's called a microaggression, which is almost words hurt. It's not a punch in the face, but it could be hurt saying that. Classic examples are words like the N-word, where one doesn't even on a show like this to explore it, say it, although comics and others often do. There seems to be universal agreement about that. Other condescending words about women or other minorities, Jews, other things like that. There seems to be agreement. Those seem reasonable, and the history of what had happened to African Americans of the Holocaust, all that makes perfect sense. What then has gone off the rails that people now find being expected to acknowledge people a certain way is a step too far?
You know, this is something that started with good intentions and started off well, and that, yes, there are certain very bigoted words like the N-word and others as well that really did need to go from public discourse and that really were very damaging. And people rightly put their foot down about that and insisted those are not acceptable words. But it went way beyond that. And now there's kind of a policing of language that's, in my view, mostly just annoying. But I think people in most lines of work look at this as a kind of elitism and a kind of condescension. The very term microaggression is a very elitist term. I mean, if you're working, let us say, the graveyard shift at Quick Mart, and let's say you're a young woman working the graveyard shift at Quick Mart, you know, you have macroaggressions going on every day against you, and you don't have time for microaggressions. And the very idea that people are offended because somebody used the wrong word is really very, itself is really objectionable. And it reflects something very, yes, very elitist about the society, that we focus on microaggressions and ignore the macroaggressions. When people lose their livelihoods, when people can't pay their medical bills, when people are getting thrown out of their houses, these are much more important than just somebody using the wrong word. And so the very idea of microaggressions, I think, is something that, you know, people look very askance at. And I think when people say they don't like political correctness, I think it's things like microaggressions that turns them off.
We have a caller. John, you're on the air.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning to you. We're doing fine. You have a question or a statement for my guest?
I do have a question. Right. I'm retired, so I've seen Republican presidents and administrations and Democrat administrations come and go. What do you think is the possibility in the next 10 to 20 years, or maybe even longer, of a significant third party to offset the legislation that we seem to see? For instance, a bill will be passed that favors the Republican point of view, and then later be nullified by a Democrat. What do you think of it, especially when you look at Canada and England and even France, and they have more than two significant parties?
John, that's a great question. You know, we've dabbled in third parties before. Historically, they often introduce things, Social Security, retirement benefits, whatnot, that later become standard. David's the political scientist here, and it does seem that our politics are deadlocked for the last quarter century or so between these two parties, and people are honestly frustrated. John's got a great point. Isn't that a precondition for the emergence of a, I don't know, middle ground party or a nationalist in a neutral sense party?
Well, you know, you do have a problem that you have a convergence of parties in some respect. I mean, it's remarkable because people think of this huge partisan divide, but in economics, up until recently at least, and even now, the parties are pretty much in agreement on a kind of laissez-faire economics. You know, people forget, you know, Milton Friedman was very popular in the Democratic Party. Not just in the Republican Party, and his policies became the policies that ran the country to some degree. And so, you know, the partisan divide, I'd say, is more about things like identity politics than it is about things like economics. Now, that may be changing, but certainly until now, that's been the case. So we shouldn't overstate the divisions between the two parties. Now, as a third party, in principle, that would be a great idea. And I think one of the most dysfunctional things about the American system is you have these two mostly moribund parties that have simply been around too long, that really could use some stimulation by some third party that would address issues that are not properly being addressed by the two parties. But the whole structure of the American system seems to weigh against a third party, even at the local level, let alone at the national level. And we haven't really had an effective third party in terms of one with staying power, one that doesn't, you know, we had H. Ross Perot won 19% of the vote in 1992, but it didn't really have any staying power as a separate party. I think the only way that would happen is if you really had the existing parties split apart and a large part of the Democrats would link up with some independent groups and form a third party. And you've got major figures in the Democratic Party, like, let us say, Elizabeth Warren joining up with Bernie Sanders or something like that. And then a whole labor union would go with them or something like that. That's a possibility. In theory, it's a possibility. But I think it would require a big split for that to be effective. I don't really see any other way you'd get anything more than a party that would win 1 or 2% of the vote, unfortunately, because I think it would be much better if that weren't the case.
You know, the multi-party thing works two ways. It allows multiple opinions, each to have a representative, but it can also create problems of a unified governmental action when things of Israel and multi-party states in general, where every view has a party, and then you got to patch them all together. Interestingly enough, you do get individuals running, sort of embodying it, Ross Perot, and now Donald Trump. And many people have said that if Trump had slightly broadened the base or somehow done other things, he could be a figure for something like a populist center. My thought is it may very well be the case that every election after this, the issues he raises, why he will pass, will have to be addressed by parties, because what he has shown is that it's out there. And if you articulate it, you can get elected. It's almost as if the Republican Party will learn this lesson, seeing what happened to them if they face another Trump on that debate stage who makes fun of all of them not dealing with these kinds of bread and butter.
Could I just jump in on that?
Yeah, please.
I think one of the issues that Trump has addressed is the issue of anger. There's always been a lot of anger in the American public since at least the 70s, owing, I would say, mostly to the decline of living standards more than anything else. And it's been particularly severe since the Great Recession. And first of all, the right is much better at channeling anger than the left. The right understands anger, whereas the left just doesn't like it. Trump has been, you know, Trump doesn't have a mind for politics, but he has a nose for politics. And he was able to sense things that others were not able to sense. And one of them was the degree of anger that the public was feeling in 2016. And he was able to channel the anger and do it far better than anyone else. And it is for that reason he was elected, his ability to channel anger. And so I think really somebody needs to address that in a more productive way, in a way that will more address the issues underlying the anger, in particular the decline of living standards. Trump is not the man to do that, and he's made it worse by all reasonable indications. And I guess what I find it disturbing is I'm not really seeing the Democratic Party making a very strong effort to address the anger issue, as well as the underlying issues that have led to the anger.
John, by the way, if you're still on the line, thanks for the call. It's a great call, please call us again. Very provocative to think about. It's interesting, I just had made a note to myself here, that liberals and progressives in general have been for free speech, ACLU, you know, fighting for these things. Yet at the same time, that very orientation is now narrowing down free speech. I guess the bottom line is, do words hurt? And it's sort of a dilemma. If you let people say everything for free speech, are you also opening the door for or prompting others to do or supporting prejudice and discrimination and a bunch of other things? So we'll never get any change. Or if you say it's just words, and it doesn't matter until we get the big change, are we never going to start the big change unless we start with the words themselves?
Well, I'm an old-fashioned leftist, and I believe in free speech, period, and the only exceptions are a clear and immediate threat to public safety, and that's it. Other than that, basically, free speech is free speech, and it doesn't matter if it hurts or not. That's my view. I put in all my course syllabi that my courses are very offensive, and if you don't like it, you can take another course. I put it in bold in all my syllabi. So that's my take on it. I think there is some tendency on the left to try and circumscribe free speech. I don't think it's as big a problem as it would be if you read Breitbart News. I personally have never been squelched on campus. I think it's more of a problem on these very small elite colleges like Oberlin. It is a problem, though. Even if it's overstated, it is a problem. And I think it reflects poorly on the left that they're trying to resort to restricting free speech as a basic principle. First of all, it doesn't work. Every time you try and restrict free speech, the thing you're trying to restrict just goes underground and becomes even more virile and potent underground. If you restrict racist speech, it doesn't go away completely. It just gets worse, in my view, because it's been repressed. Repression just doesn't work. The best thing to do with ugly speech is basically counter ugly speech, is my view.
With other ugly speech?
No, with opposition to it. If you have racist speech, you have people countering the racist speech. That's the best answer to racist speech, in my view. But banning racist speech simply doesn't work, and there's no point in trying to implement it on that basis.
We're running out of time, David. We got about 45 seconds left. Quick thing, in your classes, what's the thing that students seem to object the most to? You said they often do. What sets them off?
What sets them off? You know, In the past, I tend to be very critical of U.S. foreign policy. Most of my classes are in foreign policy, and I'm very critical of U.S. foreign policy as a major cause of disruption and injustice in the world over periods of time. Students used to object to that as unpatriotic and objectionable on patriotic grounds. I don't get that so much anymore because, as I said, I think the public is now turning in an anti-interventionist direction.
David, we're going to have to go. We're down to 10 seconds. Folks, thanks for tuning in. David Gibbs, New University of Arizona, has been our guest. See you next time on Smart Talk. Al Bergeson, and we're out.